America at a Crossroads is a weekly live webinar series that brings together journalists, scholars, thought leaders, and policymakers for discussions regarding the state of American democracy, where we've been, where we are, and where we're going. The series was jointly founded by Jews United for Democracy and Justice and Community Advocates, Inc. To register for our live webinars, join our email list at JewsUnitedForDemocracy.org.
Thank you all. And of course, you know that the city of Paris has a reputation of being the city of light. I don't know why it singled me out at this moment not to do so, but here I am. And we also want to hear from you, especially during this hour, a little later on, the questions that you'll put in the Q&A box, because this is a very personal matter, how we choose to be engaged. This is a remarkable book about remarkable circumstances, a remarkable moment in our history when 250 years ago, less a week, the men who gathered in Philadelphia signed their lives, their fortune, and their sacred honor to a document that could take it all away. And they had plenty of all of these. And so to discuss how to be a dissident in an age of fear is something that is very apt for this moment for our discussion. As you heard, Julia Angwin joins us, an award-winning investigative journalist, a best-selling author, and someone whose work focuses on the impact of technology on society, data privacy, surveillance, and algorithmic bias. She's a Pulitzer Prize winner, a former reporter for the Wall Street Journal and ProPublica, and founder of a nonprofit investigative reporting organization. Thank you so much, Julia.
It's great to be here. Thank you for hosting us.
And Ami Fields-Myers, a senior fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School's Allen Lab for Democracy Renovation, former senior policy advisor at the White House, where he led U.S. policy initiatives related to civil rights and racially and religiously motivated violence. His work, it's about public policy and culture. It appears in so many publications, The Atlantic, Foreign Policy, Newsweek, and many others I'm sure you've read, and he's all of 30 years old. So thank you for joining us as well. I'm sure we'll be hearing a great deal more of you two in the future. So I mentioned to both of you what happened 250 years ago. And in the many, many decades since, Americans have tended to look abroad at dissidents, at revolutionaries, at protesters, at the mothers of Argentina looking for their desaparecidos, their lost children, at the dissidents in the Soviet Union. And one of our leaders here, Zev Yaroslavsky, was very active about that in the 70s and 80s in Los Angeles. And it all seemed alien, like, oh, it's over there, or it's all done with here, and it's all settled. Why isn't it? And what are the obstacles to getting us to think like the dissidents, like we need to, like the founders of 250 years ago, instead of just spectators?
Julia?
Well, I guess that's the question that we started this whole investigation with. Basically, Ami and I had been sort of chatting, and we, after the election, we were sort of talking about what should we do? and we thought we must learn from people who have done this overseas, right? Like our initial thought was like, all these people have been doing this all around the world. Let's go ask them questions. And so we did. We started talking to dissidents from around the world. But what we actually realized was that there was a lot happening here too. And so we ended up starting to talk to people inside the US who are doing lots of courageous things, and also recognizing the history of dissent in the United States. We have a strong tradition of that here. And so ultimately, our book is sort of lessons that we've extracted from not just the foreign dissidents that you hear about, but actually the people here who you haven't heard about maybe as much as you should have.
And how would you define protest versus dissident? Because one seems to be plunged much more deeply and perhaps with no reverse on the shift for the car to say, this is what I am, this is what matters to me.
One way to think about why we chose the term dissident and the concept of a dissident is because of the changing conditions in the United States right now. A lot of us associate dissidents not with democracy, though we've certainly seen dissent and dissidents in democracy, but with authoritarianism, which is what we're beginning to experience now. or I should say we're probably about a decade into our descent into authoritarianism right now. And part of the reason that we choose this term is because authoritarianism looks different now than it used to look, right? Authoritarianism, it's not, as I have said to other audiences, it's not your grandmother's, it's not your bubby's authoritarianism, right? This authoritarianism no longer rides into town on the back of a coup. It feels very different. It often comes in through elections. People like Maduro, people like Orban, people like Putin were all elected in democratic elections. And then over time, restricted the civic airspace. And it became harder and harder to maneuver without extraordinary risk. And that's what happens under authoritarianism. American activism is generally happens through people looking for what protest march to attend, but even more than that, where to cast a vote, how to get involved in a campaign. And those things are all really important. But one of the things that we found in our research and in our reporting is that it's generally electoral politics when authoritarianism begins is generally not enough. You generally need civil resistance in order to push back on authoritarianism when the president or the government starts to capture institutions and starts to make it harder for people to take individual risks and to express themselves and express their democratic choices. So the difference in dissent is that it necessitates some amount of risk that we're generally not used to in our American civic discourse. And that's, the book is about people who have taken those risks anyway, whether in their workplace or in their community or in their school, in whatever their context is.
There are a number of questions that you think people need to ask themselves as we move along and or are pushed along into this process through the authoritarianism we're seeing now. One of them is how to define me or we. How big is your community? What is at stake? Are you waiting to go out and protest until something affects you directly? Or like the people in Minneapolis, are you seeing your larger sense of community, people you may not even know, being affected by this and saying, this has got a prop wash that's going to come back on me?
Yeah, I think one of the things that was so interesting for us was that, you know, we actually started this project without a hypothesis. We didn't have a clear idea what these dissidents were going to tell us. And what we found was we kept hearing the same stories from all over the world. And actually, these stories were different than what we thought. We thought we were going to hear about, you know, the man standing in front of the tank and those brave moments and the spy craft of people sending coded messages. And we definitely did hear some of that. But actually, what we heard a lot about was how the most important thing is to care for other people. And that, in fact, you have to care for people that you don't know. Because the whole game of authoritarianism is to make everyone so afraid that they just hide and they're apathetic. And the only way out is for people to band together. And they have to band together in bigger groups than their natural formations, right? Our natural family and friend group is not going to be big enough. And so we have to start caring about people beyond where our own immediate worldview. And Minneapolis, of course, was a perfect example of that, right? This is people who were watching out for their neighbors who they may not know, children who are walking to school who they may not know, but they all realized that together they had to come together as a community. And that was actually very effective resistance, right? Eventually, they did manage to succeed in their goal, which was to reclaim their community and make it safe for the people there. And also, they built something that was a little scary, right? That ICE hasn't come back there because they're like, you know what? I don't know if I want to play that game again. So this works, but you have to expand your vision to include people that you haven't previously thought about.
And as I was reading the book, I was thinking of incidents where people who had protested, who had stood out and done something that other people found to be disagreeable, were attacked. And I'm thinking of George Tiller, the doctor who performed late term abortions for women who had deformed or dead fetuses, who was killed in the vestry of his church. I'm thinking of the newspaper columnists who were fired after 9/11 for criticizing George Bush. But those were private actions by a company, by a crazed individual. What you're talking about is the government itself, agencies of the government taking action, which in a way does generate more fear, because you know it's lined up for, you know, through perhaps courts, through prison systems, through all manner of responding to you. You may be afraid you're losing your global entry privileges. You may be afraid you're going to go to jail. And all of those are legitimate, but it's all backed up by this incredible power of the government. And I think that's what people are recalibrating right now.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what people are recalibrating right now. Though I will say, Pat, that we were humbled and inspired by elements of American history where people who don't share at least my identity and some of, you know, Julia's identities as white people in the United States have been doing this for a long time. And I think that there is a storied history of people who've been pushing back. We came across the term, a term that I had not heard in the American political discourse before, which is racial authoritarianism, meaning that there are people who have lived under shades of authoritarianism and political repression in the United States as long as the United States has existed. We weren't a full democracy, according to most metrics, until 1965. And if you look to any number of people before and even after that, there are folks who have had to stand up to the U.S. government themselves. We think about people during the Red Scare, during purges of the U.S. government by President Truman. We look to J. Edgar Hoover era of the FBI when Black activists were repressed and spied upon, and even post 9/11 and into many years after 9/11 when Arab Americans and Muslim Americans had people coming into their churches. And so there is a long history of people standing up even to the U.S. government. And I will say one of the sobering pieces that's come out of our research that we've seen even more recently, there's an index called VDEM, the Varieties of Democracy Index, that is the most impressive quantitative study of democracy in the world, how democracies are doing across the board. And what that index finds is that the levels of democracy in the United States, measured by freedom of expression, and other metrics of democracy, are now back to 1965 levels. So
1965, which was about the time that the Civil Rights Bill was signed and we were seeing Jim Crow protests.
Precisely. And so it is time to reach back to those moments and also to look to folks all over the world who have done this. And just because we're not prepared, just because we don't feel prepared, doesn't mean — I think this is actually a very American shade of American exceptionalism — that even our despair in this moment has sort of taken on the color of American exceptionalism. But the truth is that there are folks all over the world and folks all over this book who have found ways to push back.
We always hear from those of us who are watching us right now, and I do want to hear from your questions. But if you have personal experiences of this, if you've grappled with this and come to decisions about what are you going to do, what can you do? As the phrase goes, nobody can do everything, but everybody can do something. So some of your personal stories, I think we'd like to hear. Julia, in the book, you write about the different kinds of fear. There's the immediate fear. You open with a man who works at HUD, who is an outspoken man and who kind of anticipates the consequences to the extent that he cleared off his desk. So he knew that when he was fired, he wouldn't have to do like the walk of shame with a big old box of stuff. But there's fear of losing your job and your money, your standing, the fear of the consequences now to your family, as we've seen in these last few years that families get doxxed and threatened. A judge's son was killed on his own doorstep by someone who opposed the judge. The doxxing and the death threats, whether you're willing to put your family through that. But then there's the other fear of not being able to live — I think your phrase was an honest life — not being able to live with yourself by turning a blind eye to what's going on.
Yeah, it was so interesting that so many people we interviewed described this tension to us in different ways. And they all a lot of them said, I'm not courageous. I'm actually just doing what I have to do because of my — I can't live with myself if I don't. And so that second fear is this sort of existential fear that at some point things become so immoral or so they're so problematic for their values that a person says, you know what, I'm willing to risk that more immediate fear of losing my job, et cetera, because I don't want to lose myself. Sometimes it's motivated by faith. Sometimes it's just your personal values. Paul, who are talking about, who we write about in the book, was working at HUD in the civil rights office. And the new administration came in and started gutting the office. And he, as a child of Nigerian immigrants, as a Black man in America, was like, you know, civil rights is personal for him. He's in that job because civil rights advances. He is able to live in unsegregated housing because of civil rights. So as he saw them eviscerating the Fair Housing Act, which is really one of the strongest and most landmark pieces of civil rights legislation, he realized he couldn't live with himself at a certain point. And so he started to organize his colleagues, and they wrote a letter to Congress describing all of the illegal things that were happening in their office. And he was, as he predicted, he was marched out of his office and fired. But he is still to this day advocating, has filed a lawsuit against HUD, and has devoted his life to this. And this is the kind of thing that is, he describes it as, he says, I'm not courageous. I'm just doing what I have to do. And I think this is something we kept hearing over and over, is that there was a certain point at which people felt like they couldn't live with themselves. And so what we talk about when we say, how to be a dissident, the way to be a dissident is to listen to that inner voice, to listen to the values you already have. You don't have to do anything to create that. You already have values, and it's about sticking with them, even when sometimes that might mean some short-term pain.
And we have seen people, ordinary people, step out, people who didn't seem to be in taking part in a protest even, but to protect and defend people, for example, who were being beaten by ICE, or who looked like they were being insulted by somebody spewing racism at the gas station. And I think we have, and maybe you've found this to be true, that it's less calculated sometimes than just an impulse to do the right thing. Is that true, Ami?
Yeah. I would say that there are two answers to this question, and they are, as they often are, entirely contradictory. So on the one hand, it is an impulse. And what we're describing as what Julia is describing is what we call in the book a moral collision. When you have these two fears bumping up against each other. And what is it? The book really is about, what does it take? Everything after that first chapter in the book, where we're talking about following that inner voice, is about what does it take to follow that inner voice. So I would say two things. On the one hand, sometimes it is an impulse. We hear from people over and over again. We talked to over 120 dissidents, scholars, activists on five continents all over the world. And what's remarkable is you start to see patterns in that data. So yes, there are a lot of people who said the thing that activated them was starting with something small, passing out water bottles at a protest, bringing blankets to people who are out on the front lines, and then witnessing either the violence or brutality or just the camaraderie that's happening among activists that brought them in, and then slowly and gradually emerging, maybe going up the ladder of activism and doing other things. But I also want to say that one myth that was dispelled for me, there was a lot of stuff in the reporting of this book that was surprising. And as Julia said, we really didn't have a thesis when we went into this. One thing that was surprising is that a lot of the acts of dissent that I expected, that I imagined happened spontaneously, did not. That practicing and preparing and planning with others and being really, really precise about what your role is in the broader movement, it is extraordinarily important in emboldening people to be able to do this kind of work. And the example I'll give is the example of, some folks on this call will know this, but everyone in America knows about the lunch counter protest in the civil rights movement. Fewer people know about what we would call in the book sort of the day before, the night before, that for 2 years, every Tuesday night, there were workshops in a Nashville, Tennessee church basement, where people were learning Gandhian nonviolence and basically how to just get hit in the head or have ashes strewn about in your face by people who are going to be aggressive and violent to you at the lunch counter. And I think in order to be able to do things that are preternaturally that allow you to be still, you really do, in general, need to be able to do a lot of preparation. And so I would, for me, that myth was dispelled of the spontaneous action. And I am encouraging friends and family more and more to actually get trained in some of this stuff, because I think it's really important.
I'd like to hear again from those of you who are watching, if you've had moments like the ones that Ami is describing, where it's come to you to say, I have to do something. I can't stand by anymore. Did you do some training? Did you jump into the fray? Have you talked with your family about this and told them, this is what I plan to do if X happens? So please get ready with my bail money, or bring me sandwiches, or whatever it is I'm going to need. Because those are important moments, and we're approaching them closer and closer, or rather they're perhaps approaching us more and more closely. Julia, this is for you, because you're the tech expert here. I think Timothy Snyder used the term anticipatory obedience, and how people may be self-censoring, like you're writing something online saying, gee, before I hit the send button, do I really want to buy the kind of trouble that this may be getting me into? And just this week, we've seen that Jeanine Pirro in Washington subpoenaed trying to get information from Reddit and from Twitter about two anonymous posters who have criticized law enforcement. So it's the intimidation anticipatorily, if that's a word, before there's almost any kind of action or offense.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that is really terrifying about this authoritarian moment is that we really haven't ever seen the combination of the amount of technical surveillance capacity and an authoritarian regime combined this way, right? Last time we had somebody try to be this much of a surveillance state, you know, maybe it was like the Stasi in East Germany, and they had like one out of every 10 people they had recruited as an informant, and they had little secret spy cameras. But when you look at all that stuff, it is just child's play compared to the surveillance infrastructure that we have now. And the fact that we all communicate with each other through devices that we don't control, and that the government can tap into and coerce these companies to give data about us, is a really terrifying moment. When you talk to activists, they all say something along the lines of, to really do this work well, you have to be a nun or a saint. Basically, you have to never do anything wrong, because they will use it against you. But of course, it's also just worth noting, no one really is a nun or a saint. So they're always going to try to have something on you. So we provide some tips in the book that I think most people who are activists, there's plenty of guides out there. You know, don't do stupid things. Don't post stupid things on the internet. Use encrypted messaging. You know, we give some advice about what to do with your phone at a protest. None of this is particularly unique. But I think one thing, it's really important to say, why is that true? Because actually, what are we trying to get to here? And I think the reason it matters is because when you think about authoritarianism, we talk about police states, we talk about violence, we talk about gulags, but really it's a narrative war. It's whose narrative is winning, right? So when they say, oh, this activist is posting bad stuff, they're trying to win a narrative war to make the other side look bad. The reason you have to do practice, as Ami was talking about, the reason to practice for protest, for instance, is because you want to resist your human impulse to become violent. The reason you want to do that is not because you can feel how you feel about the morality of violence, but the data is very clear that nonviolent protest is 10 times more effective than violent. The reason it's more effective is because you're winning the narrative war. So you have to, when you put all these things together, you have to always remember, what's the game I'm playing? The game I'm playing here is a narrative game. And so that's why you, when you're thinking about being a nun or a saint online, it's not because you actually think you're going to be able to escape that surveillance. It's because you recognize that each side is trying to win that vast majority of the population that really hasn't focused on it or really isn't sure how they feel. Those are the votes you're trying to win for your side. And everything has to be measured in that context.
And in the book, you talk about the phone, you know, this thing you carry with you that can be an enemy to yourself. And people don't practice, I mean, people will practice safe sex and safe driving, but they don't very much practice safe phone practices. And I'm a little paranoid about it. And for example, you cite that police can force you to use a biometric password. But if you use an actual like alphanumeric password, that's a different matter. So that's what I use. And I also, this may be paranoid, but you know, those little baby bead bracelets that everybody has, you know, with the, or Taylor Swift bracelets. I have one of those with my lawyer's name and number, so I don't have to open my phone to get it if it comes to that. So I don't know if that's a contradiction.
That's a smart move, actually. I like the bracelet.
You shouldn't have said that out loud, Pat. Now we all know.
Oh, wow. Okay. Wow. I'm completely honored. So that's the kind of thing you have to be aware of. There's another thing I want to ask Ami about, which is how the percentage of fear relates to the percentage of actual persecution, repression. And, you know, we get the word decimate from Rome, because the Roman legions, if they acted out of line in some legion or group of legionnaires, they would kill 1 out of 10, but the other 9 would be scared straight. And so to what extent, what are those numbers and percentages we're looking about? Fear versus actual attacks, persecutions, arrests, however you want to characterize them.
The best way to understand this is to look at Russia. Under Vladimir Putin. And actually, even to start before you go to Putin, to look at Russia in the late Soviet Union, where the apparatus of fear that existed was extraordinarily costly and burdensome to maintain. There was a police state, and there was spying, and everyone was paranoid. And what later authoritarians have found, and Putin is leading among them, preeminent among them, is that it doesn't actually take that much to make a broad population think twice about dissenting or pushing back. And what Putin does is something that academics call selective repression or selective persecution, which is that he picks a person or two, generally a prominent person or two in every industry, and makes an example of them. And so, in Russia, it's like 25 times, we should go back and find the exact number, but it's something like 20 or 25 times more likely that an immediate member of your family has been killed in a car accident than that you would know, that you might know somebody who has ended up as a political prisoner. There aren't that many political prisoners in Russia. It's actually pretty low down the list of other places. For a long time, Syria was much higher, and other, until recently, in other parts of the world. And yet people think twice. And there are a lot of people in Russia who would never dare at this point to criticize the government, because they have seen the representative examples of the people in every industry, from musicians to politicians to everyone in between, who have been either disappeared or put in prison for long periods of time or killed. And so that's how this works. Now, it's not a one-to-one. I think it would be hysterical to suggest that what's happening in the United States right now is the equivalent of what has happened over the last 20 or 25 years in Russia. But we do see something thematically very similar, which is taking selective examples, certainly among political opponents of the presidents, but also folks in academia, and in in the legal profession and other industries across the world. You look at somebody like Viktor Orban, who generally was not engaging in force or violent repression, but would, during his tenure, take the independent outlets, the few independent outlets that continue to exist, and make an example of them by subjecting them to long investigations and denying them government funding, et cetera. So once a few of those things happen, the chill becomes, we know from all over the world, the chill becomes sort of irresistible and hard to push back upon.
I would like to get a sense from Judy about how people, because I'm sure people who are listening are thinking, I want to take part, I want to do something, but how, in a way, you protect yourself when something that's magnified since the 1960s, when we saw the civil rights protests, is social media. And you use the example of a couple of people who mounted protests against advertisers who had supported a particularly offensive cause, or I can't remember the reason. But these people didn't just get nasty letters dropped in their mailbox. They got doxxed. They got racist, sexist comments and threats. And so that sort of thing does come to people's mind when, gee, I'd really like to go out there and fill in the blank of protest or dissent, but what about this? What would happen to me?
Yeah, I think that the chapter we have on the woman who runs this like ad accountability firm, essentially what she does, it's a nonprofit where they notify advertisers that that often are unaware that their ads are on sort of hate sites or sites that are extremist, and essentially, like, you know, is a watchdog. And of course this is controversial work, so I feel like we learned a lot from her story, because she, more than most, took a very like deliberate and rational approach to the fear. She was like, okay, I'm being persecuted online. I've come home and there's a stalker outside my house. There's all these scary things happening. I'm being sued. What should I do? And so she actually did a couple things. One is she went and took some, you know, actual physical training on self-defense. But another thing she did was she realized that she could really, she had to remind herself, like, who was there for her. This is a little bit of the planning. She wrote a list of all the people who would be there for her if there was a problem. And then the concentric circles of, like, the closest possible people and then the wider group. And she kept it on her desk as a reminder, like, there's all these people who will actually help me. And she developed a sort of practice around how to manage fear that was all about maintaining relationships. And that's one of the things that's really difficult for me as a longtime tech investigative reporter who wrote a book 10 years ago about how to try to combat surveillance through all sorts of technical means. And so I guess I was really hoping there was going to be some technical silver bullet that we could offer people. And you are great, Pat, to put the, you know, turn off the biometrics. There are definitely things that people should do. But in the end, everyone always told us that what is really going to save you is other people. And so being in solidarity with other people, being in networks where you have, there's a guy from Nicaragua who, you know, he told me, like, we have this list. He has a list of his wife knows exactly who to call, which lawyer, which whenever he's detained. He has, like, the different finance people who can, like, transfer his house property when he's get swept into prison so his wife can own it. You know, like, planning and having people who are on your side is essentially the best defense, which is, it's hard, but it's also sort of beautiful because it's very achievable.
Since I've been here in France, a number of my friends have asked, well, you know, why aren't Americans doing what French people do, which is they show up every weekend in Paris and they've got signs and, okay, it's your turn and your cause next weekend. And we see our protests, but I tell them that the geography is against it. Here it takes 3 or 4 hours to get to Paris, and you can then have a nice dinner after your protest and go home the same night and sleep in your bed. But you can't do that in the United States. So it has been more diffuse and refracted. How does that affect anybody's sense of involving themselves and taking part? You feel great when you see it locally, but you wonder, what's it going to do?
One thing that we learned from the Soviet dissidents, but that's a pattern that we saw actually all over the world, is the idea that we refer to in the book as finding a political home. And dissidents in the truth is, and this is sort of remarkable, there's an amazing book by a guy named Ben Nathans called To the Success of Our Hopeless Cause, which was sort of a spiritual guide for us in writing this book. It's just incredible stories, deep, deep stories of Soviet dissidents. And we think of that movement as successful, but the truth is that over time, there were only about 1,000 active dissidents at any given time in the Soviet Union. And so it was a very small movement. But one thing that they did really well was that they had these pods of other people who they could rely upon. And they were sort of constantly organizing with each other. They were staying on each other's couches but they were also doing art with each other that they were then sending out into the rest of the world to undermine the regime from within. And we hear from lots and lots of folks all over the world and all over the United States that one of the things that's most emboldening to them is not just to go to the one-off protest when they can, but actually to meet with people regularly. We have all these other sort of social safety nets in our lives. You know, in the United States, you have a health insurance or a doctor for, in case you have a medical crisis. You have a spiritual community in, you know, in case you have a personal crisis. But what happens when you have a political crisis like this? And so it's not, most of us do not have a political community. And if you have a political community of people who you're regularly gathering with, people who you have regular, who you know that you share values with, you can ask this question in a more dynamic way. Then you're not just relying on whether there's somebody who has a protest that's happening nearby, but you're thinking about the actual problems that you're actually facing, and then working together both to embolden each other to get bigger and broader in your ambitions, in your political ambitions, but also being able to respond to things as they go in a more dynamic way. So we advocate in our book, and we hear about this from folks all over the place, including many undocumented folks who we spoke to who were living lives of extraordinary fear in the United States, even before Trump and Trumpism, and who have said largely that their activism has had, that they have been able to come out and to live lives that have more dignity, but that are also more politically aligned with where they stand because they have people who are like them, who they're gathering with regularly. And we see this from Nicaragua to Russia to everywhere in between.
We've got some great questions and comments coming in. Maybe it's time for, like, people can buy insurance after you get arrested in a protest, not just bail bonds, but, like, you know, taking care of the kids and seeing that somebody is moving the car so you don't get tickets. There's just lots of ways I think that community can express itself, as you were saying.
Yeah.
Many people have asked, for those who've been harmed by Trump's behavior, including those who've been fired, who've lost their jobs as a result of DOJ's actions, or who've been defamed, and all who have been pursued, consider E. Jean Carroll now being pursued by the government. Do they have recourse, or will Trump and his henchmen get away with this? In other words, do we have, like, a little over 2 more years of this, or is this now embedded in the psyche of what is the real deep state?
I think one thing that really came across to us in our reporting was that these fights are not really always defined by the electoral cycle. So the fight against authoritarianism is something that has to be done on all fronts. Basically, communities have to throw sand in the gears wherever they can, right? So the people who are fighting against ICE and supporting the families who are harmed by them are doing their work, but so are the people who are, like Paul, who is suing HUD and trying to bring accountability. And there are tons of government workers who have lost their jobs who are really sacrificing their own personal careers to demand accountability from the government to continue to bring those cases. But everyone can do an action in their own lane, right? Like, there are people at universities who have organized and prevented their universities from caving in to government demands. And so I think we have a situation where there's always something you can do because everyone is in a particular lane. And so it's like, it in whatever lane you're in, figure out who needs to be organized and do it. Like, what I did is, while we're writing, reporting this book, I just got really excited about the fact that I didn't know anyone on my block. So I put flyers on every house on my street and I had a cocktail party. And now I have a group chat for everyone and we help each other plow snow. And so this is actually the work of fighting authoritarianism just as much as anything else. So everyone has something that they can do.
Do you recommend paper and pen? I know I'm sounding a little paranoid, but...
I think, yes. I think it was... was it one of the Nicaraguans, Ami, who told us that only use paper and pen? So paper and pen is great. It's a really good tool. And so, yes. But I also think it's really important to know that there's only you have to do what you can on protecting yourself. But once again, your real protection is other people.
Many people, this is one of our questions that's come in. So many people in your book are foreign, as you point out. Many of them have been sent to prison. And apart from those, the question is, what are examples of acts of moral courage you've been found to be especially effective in combating these current behaviors.
One action that I was just actually thinking about as Julia was talking, as answering this last question, is because I do think that there's a sense of deep injustice. Like, are these guys really going to get away with this? And across time and space, we saw that sometimes the thing to do is, and the morally courageous thing to do, is to just keep a record of what's going on and to bear witness to what's going on. Now, it is tempting to listen to me say that and to say, okay, well, that's sort of shallow and immediate. But we heard stories from all over the world of people who kept track of, you know, in some cases, atrocities, in other cases, just acts of political repression and political injustice. And in many, many cases, there are tribunals, there are truth and reconciliation commissions, there are and there will be opportunities to bear witness to what happened and to seek justice in some symbolic or actual pragmatic way. Some of our reporting takes place actually outside of the Delaney Hall facility. Julia has spent a good amount of time there. I say that's Julia.
It's the one in New Jersey.
Yes, exactly. The ICE detention facility in New Jersey, where we were spending time a year ago or so. And as of the last couple of weeks, what you've probably begun to see in the national news story is that there's a hunger strike going on, trying to bring attention to really, truly abysmal conditions. No good drinking water, freezing cold temperatures, and the list just goes on and on. And one of the ways that people have understood what's going on and the message of those hunger strikers has gotten out, so much so that we're now seeing politicians demand entry into these facilities and demand changes to the conditions happening to these most vulnerable people, among the most vulnerable people in our country, is the people who have been bearing witness outside and who have been supporting the families outside the facility, who have developed the trust, but also who have just been watching the entire time and so have a record of what's been going on.
That's actually chapter to be, in a way, the most helpful, because there's so much of a how-to about helping the people inside that facility and the people who were trying to get in to see them, their relatives.
Exactly. And so the one other thing I'll just add to this is that we've seen this in other parts of the world, but there will always, authoritarians will always lie and authoritarians will always tell a story. And as Julia said before, this is a narrative war. But we even hear from people like Václav Havel in Czechoslovakia in the 60s and 70s and 80s, who says that the work of a dissident is to tell the truth, is just to say this is what's happening when the authoritarians are saying, don't believe your lying eyes.
And if you can start with that,
that we can all do. We can all do that work, and we can especially all do that work now that we all have one of these in our pockets at all times.
There are a couple of stories I want to share with you. One of our viewers who didn't post a name said, Terry and I go each week and I go each week and protest all the Trump corruption and have done this over a year. It actually is spontaneous among our group members and lots of camaraderie to bind us in common purpose to not be silent. This sounds like a message you've been hearing again and again.
Yeah, I love what Terry is saying, because one of the things I think that is we found so lovely in our reporting is that actually there's a lot of joy in this work. People think about this as like, oh, I have to do this, it's my civic duty. Actually, people really thrive on having a shared moral purpose with other people working together on common cause. And we see it over and over again. The people describe doing the work of dissidents, of the group that I spent time with in front of Delaney Hall, like, is an incredibly tight-knit group of people who've become really close friends just through providing service to the families and the inmates. That's what their job is. They go there every week to provide water and food and support and translation services, legal services, and they are now a real family. There's a real pleasure. We talk about the pleasure of agency, that giving you gain back some power in a feeling where the whole goal of authoritarianism is to make you feel powerless. And mm-hmm. every small victory, you get that bit of power back, even if it's just getting one person the pepper spray out of their eyes with some water, you know?
Here's a story from Amy. Mainly, I've been talking with people around me, a lot of younger people who work at the grocery store. They don't know what's happening. So I write down information about Heather Cox Richardson and her Letters from an American, which you both know, of course. To get started on being informed, I carry around paper and pen in case I need to write it down for someone. Well, there you go, Amy. And another comment from Janet is the legacy of, where we go, the Reverend Dr. James Lawson here in Los Angeles, training in nonviolence lives on. Can Ami and Julie, both of you are familiar with California and LA, can you offer suggestions of other current offerings of resistance training? One member of Congress doing it is Representative Pramila Jayapal.
Yeah, well, Reverend Lawson, I should have said his name before, but the Tennessee basement that I referred to before was those trainings were, as you point out, were being conducted by Reverend Lawson, who had spent time in India with studying Gandhian nonviolence, and then brought those tenets back home, and was actually called, both spiritually called, but also literally got a call, we found in our reporting, from Martin Luther King, who said, I need you to come to the South. And he brought that to the South, and then obviously also to Los Angeles later on. There are a huge number of trainings, and this is the kind of thing that we, you know, maybe we can follow up specifically. There's with folks and send some links. There's a group called Freedom Trainers that Nadine Block leads, that is doing these kinds of trainings. Maria Stefan and Erica Chenoweth, who have done the work of finding that when 3.5% of a population rises up and takes to the streets, that in general, with some caveats, no authoritarian regime has survived that. Maria Stefan does a huge number of trainings. She is with the Horizons Institute. Mm-hmm. Julia, maybe there are others that come to mind for you.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of trainings. And honestly, the ones that are probably going to be best are going to be very local, right? So I hesitate to dive into the exact specifics, but I do think that it's a great place to start, because what you do at a training is not only do you learn things, but you also find the other people, you find your political home of people who want to do similar things. And then and building on that is the work.
Here's a message from Paul. He said, the early intimidation on college campuses was successful at quieting dissent. He said, I participated at the University of Wisconsin in the early 70s and can't help but feeling disappointed that students are not organizing in numbers. I'm wondering if you found that to be the case. But he goes to a good point, which is that there are so many reasons that people have come out, like whether it's Gaza, for example, or ICE, so many things that this administration has done. Is it a little hard, unlike, say, the Vietnam War or civil rights protests, to get cohered, if that's a word, behind any one cause? And is that maybe one of the reasons things feel a little more diffuse?
I'll say something quickly on this, Julia, if you want to add. This is, as folks on this call may know, actually a strategy, and it's an authoritarian strategy, and it's also an articulated strategy by Steve Bannon, from the very beginning of the first Trump administration all the way through until now, by the far right, which is to throw so much at you that you can't manage to respond. And it's quite effective when the norms and the mores and the standards are all being attacked in such rapid succession. This is a very interesting question, and I will say I do think that the intimidation has worked to some extent. I've heard people say, why is there no massive uprising on Iran in the way that there was on Gaza? And there are plenty of sort of sociological questions to ask about that, and that's probably for another Zoom call. But intimidation works. And so this is part of the reason why it's important, I think, to be doing so much work locally and to be able to look at other people in the eye and say, are you seeing what I'm seeing? But Julia, do you want to add anything to this question?
I think that the only thing I would add is, I mean, I agree that the crackdown on campus protests was so brutal and so intense, right? And I don't blame any students for fact that they are in a very difficult situation, right? They're not, they don't have the same power that, you know, like an adult living, they're living in sort of it in a loco parentis, right? The university is their parent in this very weird relationship that we've set up in the US. And so I don't want to blame any students for not fighting hard enough. They did fight, and they were brutally cracked down on. I think it's important to note that, like, this is not the only way you can protest, right? Like, there are a lot of street protest on campus is one way, but lots of people are doing lots of things that aren't that are, you know, at Delaney Hall, there's a lot of students who are coming from universities in New York. They're not protesting on their campus, but they're working in the ICE, in front of the ICE detention center. And so I think that I just want to be careful about that. But I also do want to say that there is a demographic divide. If you go to a No Kings protest, it is actually largely older people, is what I have been told by a lot of people who have said that they've observed this. And so, and I think that has to do, this is back to the narrative message, which is that I think the younger folks are not resonating as much with the decline of democracy message because they grew up in an era of our democracy was already in trouble. And so they don't have the feeling of loss that some of the people who grew up older and who had a little bit more bought into the fact that we might have achieved all the things that we said we achieved. Yeah. And so I think there's also work to be done to bring all these groups together around a common message that resonates for everyone, which is part of the narrative war. That is the goal. You have to get to a point where everyone agrees on what we're fighting for.
We're closing in toward the end, and I know we could go on for 2 hours. You have wonderful stories and questions. I have to read this one from Anthony. He said, I've been an activist since the Green Book, since the KKK held their meetings and burned crosses in my neighborhood. As a kid, we knew our terrain, and we resisted by throwing oranges at, let's see if I can get this not to move around, throwing oranges at these meetings where vacant, undeveloped lands were usurped by corporations. The Reverend Lawson married me in Los Angeles and was my pastor and dear friend. Kent says, I live in Fullerton, and every Monday evening I do a protest with other people in nearby Brea, so it's empowering and fun to get together with like-minded people. There are a lot of questions about CBS, about 60 Minutes, and Scott Pelley fired from his job. There's a prime example, and some people would say, well, he's got a lot of money, he's okay, but he's also somebody who's high profile, who may become, as you were both saying, kind of a rallying point for people to say, if, you know, he can do it, he can dare it, I can do it.
One thing I would just add on the CBS and Scott Pelley is that it's worth taking those things very seriously because, as I mentioned, we're in a narrative war. And so capturing the media, coercing the media, intimidating the media is project number one for authoritarians. It takes up a huge amount of their time. It's one of their primary goals. You don't need that many gulags, as Ami was saying. You really need to control the media. And so fighting back against that, the fight that the resistance and all the cancellations that led to Jimmy Kimmel being reinstated was a victory, right? And so those types of victories are important to fight for.
Can I get a quick comment from Ami before we wrap up here, which is Scott Pelley could be a rallying figure. Are there other kinds of people who are ministers, for example, or older people or disabled people who, when you see them out there, you go, wow, if they can do it, I can do it?
Of course there are. And one thing that we talk about late in the book is a study. Maybe this is a good place to sort of close, but that in 1989, there was a poll that was taken. It was actually just after the wall fell, of people who had lived in East Germany, which asked the question, a year ago, did you see a nonviolent revolution coming? And of all the people who were polled, former residents of East Germany, only 5% said that they had seen the thing coming. So the question is, how is it possible that people couldn't see it coming, even among the population that was going to spark the revolution? And the answer is that people, the answer that was found in a landmark political science paper by a guy named Timur Kuran, was that people just didn't know other people shared their values. And this is something that happens over and over and over again all over the world, from Egypt to Russia to the United States, which is there is something extraordinarily important of people when they have a moment to articulate dissent so that other people can see that they are dissenting and feel emboldened to do the same.
You know, we usually spend the last minute on something upbeat, but in a way, this entire hour has been upbeat. And I'm sure everybody would like to have you back to get more pointers and more information. So I'd like to give the last word to Julia, if you would like to give us something hopeful to look forward to beyond what we've just been discussing this evening. And can you do it in 30 seconds?
I can. Well, I always joke to Ami that I'm kind of becoming a hope truther, because I feel like, actually, I didn't think America had it in us, but I feel like we're doing really well and we keep notching up victories. There are a lot of losses, but the slush fund retreat was a victory. The Delaney Hall was a victory. This is just this week, right? And so we are resisting. It continues to happen, and it's continuing to happen publicly, and more people are joining dissent just by saying things like Scott Pelley, right? And so I feel hopeful that we have a lot more resistance ahead of us.
Okay. The book is On Courage, How to Be a Dissident in an Age of Fear. Julia Angwin, Ami Fields-Meyer, we've had some great questions. I hope we can get you back again so we can do this again.
Thank you so much.
Love that. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much. And you can see on the screen, there are the upcoming programs that we'll have for you. And I hope you're looking forward to some of them as I am. Our thanks to all of the people who make these programs possible. Those of you who watch, those of you who sustain it. And of course, the great people who organize this. So thank you so much. And we'll see you in a week or two.